Okay, good. Yeah, guys, move over a little
bit. Make
more room.
It's not like there's COVID or anything. Okay, so I specifically wanted us seated around a table for two reasons. What's that? But Atlantically. I wanted to do this for two reasons. Number one, I wanted to make sure that we had a little more of a connection to each other, because we call this fellowship not only to learn Torah and grow individually, but to grow as a group, as a community, and it's hard to do that. Oh, please, grab one.
Can you toss some down this way?
Yes. It's hard to do that when we're a little disconnected from each other. The other thing I really want to try, and I'm always usually unsuccessful. Look, it's 8:14. So I said to Rabbi Avi, we really want to try to get you guys out at a normal time. And we had complaints in previous years that we kept people here till 12, 1 in the morning. No, it was never that late. I'm kidding. But we've kept people here like a decent amount of time. And it all starts earlier. So we're going to make a concerted effort to start as close to 8 o'clock as possible. So I can finish by 9 o'clock. Rabbi Avi then can start his second class at 9:05. You guys can get out of here latest 10 o'clock. Because it's a long day. And you're all working stiffs. And you're tired. But you're excited to be here, are you not?
Yes.
We're all excited. So let's go around really quickly so we can just learn each other's names. If anybody would like some paper or pens, as you see, we just very neatly distributed them on the table. Let's just go around quickly. We'll start right to my left.
Hello. Natasha. Yeah.
Yaron.
David.
Allison.
Ilana.
Miranda.
Hannah.
Barry.
Simon.
Brian.
How are you?
Justin.
Anais.
Jory.
Jory, okay.
Justin.
Justin.
Skylar.
Alexandra.
Ethan. Okay, excellent. So we have two Justins, one Jason, a lot of J's. And Jory.
Jory.
Jory, okay, and Skylar. And, okay, this is just for me. I'm just doing this. It takes me a little while. Okay, great. So welcome, everyone. I hope, first of all, I thank all of you. Just before Zahava leaves the room, hang on one second. Just so you know, Zahava is going to send out every week the homework question. I was very impressed with a lot of your answers. And please try. I'll tell you the purpose of the homework. It's very simple. You don't have to keep standing if you don't want to stay.
Okay.
Give your hand on the door.
Don't disturb her.
Okay, I won't. She doesn't trust me. The purpose of the homework question is so that a whole week doesn't go by without thinking about what we did the last week. And I just started this a few years ago. It's not to create more difficulty, as you can see. All I'm really asking you to do on the homework is to regurgitate a little of what we did in class, like the main point or two. If anybody wants to add on, you know, as we say around the Seder table, Harezeh Meshubach, all the more praiseworthy. But you don't have to. You can just kind of answer the question and get back to your day. And the more you can put into this, obviously, the more you're going to get out of it. But we're off to a great start, and I thank you all for being here. And let's continue, shall we? So, Hannah, last week, I wouldn't say we proved. I tried to demonstrate a rational basis. Who didn't like the term rational? Someone had, Scott, you had a problem with the rational thing. A rational basis for the belief in the divinity of the Torah. You notice I didn't talk about God. How do we know there's a God? You know, I made that big assumption. If anyone's actually interested in my class on God, I can send you what's going to hopefully be the first chapter in a basic Judaism book that I'm writing. And it took me 6 months to write the chapter on God. It's like 35 pages. And it's just like my ideas about what's the rational basis to believe in God. There are many. I only gave two approaches, and then some Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, about not only finding God out there, but within ourselves. So if anybody wants that, I'm happy to share that with you. Just don't, you know, if you're going to write your own book and call it yours, just, you know, put my name down there. But what I want to do is, I want to pick up where we left off last week. Just very briefly, we contrasted two events in Jewish history. What were the two events that we contrasted in Jewish history last week? The first one was the splitting of the Red Sea, and the second one was the giving of the Torah at Sinai. Now, it's okay, by the way, if you don't agree with something I've said or quoted, I'm just asking you what we said. And by all means, if there's an issue, you can either share it here or we can talk privately. What did we share last week, according to Maimonides, was the difference between these two events? Who can share? What's the major difference between the event of the splitting of the Red Sea and, yes?
So there was a personal interaction in the revelation at Mount Sinai, whereas so with the miracle, you could attribute it to a magic or...
Okay, good. So we were at both. In other words, the same Jews, we believe, were at both the giving of the splitting of the Red Sea and the giving of the Torah. But as you said, one was a more direct encounter with God. Barry, what were you going to say? Okay, but I'll come back to you then.
Oh, it's just related to that. I guess I just to say, like, the Mount Sinai was a direct God coming in front of me in Israel and showing himself directly, and I thought that was more like God was doing.
Right. So there's just one last question that you have to ask, because the obvious question all of us are going to have when we see something that looks supernatural, that looks beyond this world, that goes against the laws of nature and science, is what caused that event? And if you were standing at the splitting of the Red Sea, we would ask that question: what caused that to happen? Was that, you know, a hallucination? Was it some sort of optical illusion? Or did this really happen? Because water doesn't form a wall. And that's what the Bible, that's what the Torah says the Jews saw. They saw the water turn into a wall, and they passed through safely. The Egyptians tried following suit. They were drowned. The Jews were saved. The giving of the Torah at Sinai also seems very miraculous, but the way the great Maimonides looks at it, he doesn't view it as a miracle. Now, I think you think, like, that's not a miracle? Because he doesn't put it in that category of a supernatural event. Was there anything supernatural about the giving of the Torah? So you'll say, wasn't the mountain shaking?
Lifted up their hands.
Was it? That's a midrash. That's not what the biblical text says. And that's an important midrash, but it comes to teach something else, I think. The mountain was shaking. There was a sound of the shofar, and nobody was blowing it, but they heard the sound of the shofar, the Torah says. There was thunder, there was lightning. So it seems miraculous. But that's not really what the event was about. Well, the event at the splitting of the Red Sea, that was all about a miracle. That's literally, it's all about the splitting of the sea. What was the event at Sinai about? It was about God communicating with the Jews. And that's what they experienced. Even though they were a little miracle here and a little miracle there, that's not really what the essential purpose and essence of that event was. That was to give the Ten Commandments to the Jewish people. And that's why the Jews who witnessed that, we believe, would not be left with the same question that they would be left with at the splitting of the Red Sea. They wouldn't have to ask who was behind that, because God was talking to them. God was saying, what was the first thing God said, we believe? Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God. Asher Utzitzicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. When did these Jews leave Egypt? 7 weeks earlier. And God is telling them, so he's taking away that question. Now, again, I said this last week, this does not prove it happened. But what it does is remove one of the questions and doubts that many of us would have when confronting something supernatural. If so many people said that they saw this, they witnessed God, they heard God command them to follow in God's ways and so on and so forth, and they saw and they heard God speaking to Moses, and they were there, and that information was passed down from generation to generation, then we take that information seriously, because that's no different than any other event that we never witnessed. Okay? And that's a very, very important idea, is to try to ask ourselves, why do we believe any event took place in history that you and I never saw? We talked about that a little. You know, I don't think anyone's parents or grandparents fought in the Civil War. Have you ever met anyone who fought in the Civil War? But you believe it. Now, you asked a very good question. You said, well, are we believing it because it's written in the Bible? Because it's really old. And how do we know this has got accurate information? And my answer to that was, that's actually not the reason we believe it. We believe it, it's recorded in the Bible, but the reason we believe an event that we didn't see is because someone told us it happened. Lots of people believed it, lots of people kept telling, lots of generations, they kept passing it down and passing it down, unless you have a really good reason to believe that either the people who witnessed that event hallucinated it, if that's a word, fabricated it, made it up, or someone in history then made it up and said that 1,000 years ago they were this Jewish tribe in the wilderness, and they God spoke to, but that's never been we've never been accused of that. Okay, the Christians believe that, don't believe that, the Muslims don't believe that. Anyone who believes in monotheism believes that event took place not because it's written here, but because it was passed down. Anybody know the Hebrew word for that? The Hebrew word for that is called what? Well, Kabbalah is receiving. So that's actually close. Mesorah. Really bad translation of that in Fiddler on the Roof. Remember the song Tradition? Now, if you ask someone what's the English translation of Mesorah, they would say tradition. But you and I, when we see the Fiddler on the Roof and they sing that song Tradition, and you see the guy, you know, it's like a, it's sweet, it's nostalgic. It's not really true. It's not authentic. It's not real. Now, we think stuff handed down from generation to generation, unless there's a real issue with the information itself. It conflicts with something else. But then we really believe that it took place, not because it's recorded, okay, but because it was passed down. But we're going to talk about other things, and I mentioned this as well, that we do when a scribe writes a Torah to make sure that it actually stays. Anybody know the oldest Torah scroll ever written?
The Dead Sea Scrolls.
That's around today. Actually, a full Torah scroll. The Dead Sea Scrolls are the oldest, dated to a certain period of time. It's the Aleppo Codex. It was found in Aleppo, Syria. And they checked it and found no significant difference. It's 1,000 years old. So we have it. We have the Aleppo. I don't know where it is. It's some museum. Yeah, you should read it. It's in the Israel Museum? Probably. In Jerusalem.
After there was a fire, the riots in Aleppo, I think,
it's really good. You know, anybody knows something else that we do? Actually, it happened here on Yom Kippur. What happens when someone is reading the Torah and then they make a little mistake?
Correct. Say it again.
So somebody yells out. It's like the worst thing when you're bar mitzvah and you mess up. And I remember messing up and then somebody yells out. So these are little, there are about 8 or 9 of these little techniques that we do to try to ensure the authenticity of the written text also. So actually, on Yom Kippur, Kevin was Gabbai, he was giving out the Aliyot, and then he was like reading along, and he saw there was a letter missing. One letter is missing, you're done. The whole Torah is puzzle, and we have to put the Torah away. It's our third Torah, it's a 150-year-old Torah that was restored from Poland. We just got it like 2 years ago, so I have to call the sofer and bring them back, because whatever, it's 150 years old, it happens. But we're like crazy, one little letter. So now, that doesn't mean there can't be mistakes and issues and problems. And I really pride myself in being intellectually honest. There were traditions that were lost, oral traditions that were actually lost, if you study history. Not a significant amount, but some. And we're going to talk about that as well.
How do we know if we lost them?
We have historians who spend their lives researching this stuff. And they can tell you, they could tell you what was lost and why. I mean, I'll tell you one little quick story. Just anybody heard of Rashi? Mm-hmm. Rashi, the great biblical commentator. Where was Rashi from? He was from France. Now, I have a son. He's 18. He's studying in Israel. Why does that old Jewish day school kids go spend a gap year in Israel? Why? Free time. They don't want to start college quickly. It's partially true. Because the biggest Torah... What's that?
I said their parents tell them to go.
Their parents tell them, no, he wanted to go. The reason it started is because there's always been a tradition to send your kids to the biggest Torah scholars wherever they live. So my 12th grade teacher, he grew up in the Lower East Side. His parents sent him to Poland. This is before the Second World War. Because the biggest Torah scholars were living in Poland when he grew up in the Lower East Side in the 1930s. 1920s, 1930s. Crazy. Yeah, he was in Poland. A lot of people from New York would send their kids to Poland to learn. So my son is now in Israel, in Jerusalem, because as much as there are some great rabbis in America, there are bigger ones and there are more of them in Israel today. So where did Rashi go?
Germany.
He went to Germany. Because the greatest Torah scholars in the 1000s, 1,000 years ago, when Rashi lived, were in Germany. Now thank God, Rashi left Germany after a few years of studying there by the Tosafos. Tosafos? Anyone heard of Tosafot? If you open up a Talmud, Rashi's on the right. Tosfot represents 60 scholars on the left. Okay? Rashi goes and learns by them. He feels a responsibility to his community back in France. So he goes back. And thank God, because what happened to all the rabbis in Germany? They were all wiped out by the Crusades, by the First Crusade that was coming to liberate Jerusalem. And on the way, they figured, kill a couple of Jews. They killed more than a couple of Jews. And they wiped out some of the greatest Torahs, and they burned a lot of their writings. We lost some Torah there. Now, thankfully, Rashi got a lot of it. And this is Jewish history in a nutshell, where they literally are burning down our traditions. Somebody grabs some of it and moves on to the next country and starts it all over again. And by the way, that happened after the Holocaust. Do you know how much Torah was destroyed and decimated? We only sometimes, I mean only, talk about the 6 million, of course.
Rabbi, my synagogue I went to in London, they have a bunch of Czech scrolls, like maybe like 100, something like that, if you ever want one.
Scrolls from Czechoslovakia?
Yeah. That were saved right before the Holocaust, or like during.
Right.
It's like a really big collection of them.
So, we might need one. Thank you.
Yeah, I was like thinking.
if the Sofer can't fix this one, I'm sure he will be able to.
I'll reach out to the rabbi. Then.
So I want to get into our topic. I'm just going off on a big tangent, but I just want everyone to understand that it is a human process. Even though the Torah we believe is from God, it was then given over to us, and the oral Torah, which is our discussion tonight, which is to understand the written Torah. The written Torah, everybody's got. The Christians have it. Everybody has the Bible, the 5 books of Moses. The issue is, how do you understand the 5 books of Moses? And how do we know that there must be some kind of code to unlock the secrets of what the 5 books of Moses actually covers? Can anybody give me an example of something that is evidence that there must be something not written down, but being passed on from generation to generation to enable us to actually understand the words of the Bible? Because do we read everything? We're not fundamentalists, classically. We don't read the Bible literally all the time. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. How do you know? What's an example? Yeah?
I don't cook a kid in its mother's milk.
Okay, what about that?
I mean, it says it 3 times in the Torah. I think one time is don't eat, don't mix milk with meat. And then one time is don't benefit from the sale of milk and meat together. One of them is
don't eat it. Don't mix it.
Don't eat it.
Those are separate. And don't have benefit from it. Which is a question as to whether or not you can own stock benefit. Can you serve it to your pet? A mixture of meat and milk. Can you own stock and make money off an admixture of meat and milk? But how did you get that? Where'd you get that from, Justin? It says in the Bible, Lo tevashel gediba chalev imo. Do not mix the kid in its mother's milk. It says it 3 different times. So if you're a Bible scholar, what are you going to ask right off the bat? You're going to say, why does the Torah say it 3 different times? The Torah does not mince words. It does not add an extra letter unless there's a purpose or reason. So why does it have to repeat it 3 times? One is to teach not to cook meat and milk together, even if you don't eat it. The other one is not to eat it, and the third is not to have benefit. What else? Give me other examples. What about it? What about an eye for an eye? Do we believe that? It says in the Torah, so what do you do with it?
I think
we just cross out politically incorrect statements from the Bible? This is just...
Isn't it a value based off the value of something?
How do you know that?
You determine what the value of...
That's the answer.
...the harm.
If, God forbid, your eye or an employee's eye, let's say, is taken out in a factory, so you have to find the owner of the factory and take his eye out, that's barbaric. The Bible says an eye for an eye. We don't read that literally. No one ever did. Ever. Not from the days of Moses. How do you know? Does it say it in the Torah? Is there a little parentheses? I don't really mean this literally. It's passed down from generation to generation. It was never supposed to be written down. We're going to talk about next week why God took that chance. Maybe we'll touch on that tonight. Because it is actually written down today. But it wasn't supposed to. Anybody know where all this stuff is written today? Everything is digitized on Safari, yeah? But where is this oral tradition actually written down? Anybody know what's it called? It's called the Talmud. Okay? Guys, please, am I flying around too fast here? I'm okay? Is that all right?
Very good.
Yeah, question.
I have one thing, because you told me, you emailed me to remind you. So
What was given at Sinai?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going
to come back to that.
I'll come back to it. So here's another example. This is my favorite example. Has anyone ever seen a red pair of tefillin?
No.
Has anyone ever seen a round pair of tefillin? Mm. Right. Every pair of tefillin almost looks the same. I mean, they all look the same. They're black boxes with leather straps. They actually look very weird. And if I would tell you what, I think I said this last week, like, how do you translate tefillin in English?
Phylacteries.
One of those helpful translations. So, does it say in the Torah that all tefillin should be black?
No, it just says, like, as I showed you, right?
Like, I'm going to get to that in a second. What does it say? Bind them as a sign upon your arm and a totafot between your eyes. Now, bind what as a sign on your arm? It doesn't say what should be in the tefillin. And where between your eyes? I mean, have you ever seen anyone put on a pair of tefillin in the morning between their eyes? They look really ridiculous. Where is the tefillin supposed to go?
Above.
Supposed to go where the hairline is, between your eyes. That's why sometimes you'll see guys doing this, a little weird. They put their tefillin on, they start doing this. For my son Yosef's bar mitzvah, we gave out little mirrors. That was cute, we thought. With a compass, so you can know which way to pray towards Jerusalem. Got a mirror and a compass, everything you need to pray. So the mirror, why do you need a mirror? You want to check your hair while you're praying? You want to look good before God? You mirror because you want to make sure, because if you put the tefillin, I don't even know what to use for the head tefillin here. If you put the head tefillin on here, it's like you never put it on. It literally has to be here, which is why you see a lot of people sort of futzing around with the leather strap. Because if it's too tight, you can't really get it there. If it's too loose, it falls down. And it's like you didn't put on tefillin. Is that anywhere in the Bible? And everybody knows that. And everyone does the same thing. For thousands of years. No one has ever put on a red pair of tefillin. And now, there are some discrepancies and arguments. One big machloket about tefillin. Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Sidur HaParshiyot. When you open up the box, what's the order of the four scrolls, parchments, from the Torah that you're supposed to put in there? They don't even argue what the four parchments are, which says nowhere in the biblical text. Okay, nobody argues about that. The little argument, do you put it, is this 1, 2, 3, 4, or is this 2, 3, you know, like, what's the order? And some people, to satisfy both Rashi and Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam's opinion, they put on two pairs. Very few people, but some Chabad Lubavitch put on two pairs of tefillin. I've seen Yemenite Jews who put on two at the same time, just to satisfy both. And it's a stringency. 95% of the world puts one pair of tefillin on. But I'm just giving you another example. Take a look at your handout here. And I want to just show you a little evidence. And by the way, one of the examples you gave, we're going to get to. Take a look on page 3. These are examples of the oral Torah, the indispensability of the oral Torah. We already did number 2. We already did, that's all we did was 2. I'll do number 1. You may slaughter from your cattle. You guys have it, page 3? You may slaughter from your cattle and your flocks that Hashem has given you as I've commanded you. Anybody know what that's referring to? You were referring to this.
Yeah, maybe kosher meat.
Kosher meat? What does that mean? You will slaughter from your cattle and your flocks that Hashem has given you as I've commanded you.
The method of
shechita. Does anybody know how to shecht an animal? Do you know that? I spent 4 months when I was in rabbinical school on the laws of Shechita, and if you brought a cow right now, I wouldn't know which way was up. But I spent 4 months, and then the guys who were going to become actual butchers, I was not interested in this, but the guys who were butchers went into the lab and then actually learned practically. There are lots of ways, there are lots of specific laws and traditions. Where are they found? How does somebody learn how to become a kosher butcher? I'm not saying you need to be a butcher. What's that?
From another kosher butcher.
Yeah, where did he get it from?
It's an apprenticeship.
Right, I understand. But somebody had to know the rules and laws. Somebody had to teach that if there's a slight nick in the knife, God forbid, and somebody had slaughtered a group of animals worth a lot of money, and you find a little nick in the knife afterwards, then all of that has to be sold as non-kosher meat, and you will lose a ton of money. I know I'm sounding a little insensitive in terms of taking animal life. We'll get to that when we talk about kashrut. But I'm just talking about the issue. And the Torah here says, you may slaughter from your cattle and your flocks as I have commanded you. What do you mean, as I have commanded you? And then you'd figure the next verse would go into all the details of the laws. But it doesn't exist. There's nowhere in the Bible, in the five books of Moses, or in Tanakh, anywhere, that gives you the specifics. Where is it? I'm just trying to make a case here. Take a look, number three. Be fruitful, multiply. You guys know what that refers to? Having children. There's a tradition that you should try to have. Anybody know? Try. Can't really...
At least one boy and one girl. You're
supposed to try to have a boy and a girl to fulfill the mitzvah of be fruitful, multiply. Where does it say that? All the Bible says is be fruitful, multiply. Right? And by the way, this is where all the practical questions... Rabbi Pinney, who's teaching the other room, our senior fellowship teacher. So after his fifth son, he wanted to know from his teacher how much longer they have to continue to try to fulfill this mitzvah, because they haven't fulfilled it yet. And then he called the rabbi. He's like, I'm not answering that question. But he had a little girl at the end. It was very nice. Now look at number four. This is going to be a little weird. What don't we do on Yom Kippur? What are the things? We don't wear leather shoes.
We don't eat or drink.
By the way, is that mentioned anywhere in the Torah? No. We don't eat or drink. That's mentioned in the Torah. Right?
Marital relations.
Is that mentioned anywhere in the Torah? No. What else don't we do?
Perfume.
We don't anoint ourselves with oils, perfumes. We don't bathe. Shower. Right? All the Torah says, you shall afflict yourselves. Now, if I went around this table, I'm sure we can get a lot of creative suggestions. What does that mean to you? What's an affliction for you? For me, it would be not, I don't know. For you, it would be, but Jews for thousands of years kept Yom Kippur in the same. You get the point. I don't have to keep going on. I got a gabillion examples which demonstrate that there's some tradition that went along with the written. Now, how did that happen? How did that happen? So follow with me on page 3. Should be understood. Actually, let me clear up one other thing. What was revealed at Sinai? This is Josh's... this is Jason, I'm sorry. I called you Josh, I apologize. Yaron, I should have said Yaron. This is Yaron's question. What happened at Sinai? How many commandments did the Jewish people get? I mean, you're familiar. Well, I mean, what is it called?
The Ten Commandments.
Don't be so hesitant. You know? It's just the Ten Commandments. You learned this in Hebrew school. Right? So we got the Ten Commandments. How did we get the other... How many left are there? There's 613 commandments. Where did we get the other 603? How did that happen?
You shall and you shall not.
Right, so how did we get those? So those were given over, we believe, from God to Moses. And then Moses gave those... He actually wrote them down. We have a tradition that Moses wrote 13 Torah scrolls during his lifetime. He gave one to each of the 12 tribes. And then the 13th was put in the tabernacle. Aryeh Kaplan, in one of his amazing books, says that that 13th scroll made it eventually to King Solomon's temple. And when Jews would pilgrimage to Jerusalem on the three festivals, Pesach, Sukkot, and Shavuot, they'd be able to see Moses' actual 13th scroll. Okay, we're going to read about that. There's a lot of Kabbalah on this. I'm fluffing over a lot of Jewish mysticism and other things. It seems as though, from some opinions in the Talmud, God's original intention was to give the entire 613 over to the Jews directly, and not just the Big Ten. And some even hold that they didn't even get the Big Ten. They only got one or two, and they turned to Moshe and said, we can't take this anymore. Something very uber spiritual was happening at Sinai, and they couldn't handle it anymore. I'll tell you how we know this. Because what happened when Moses came down after 40 days and 40 nights and didn't bring up any food with him either? What was he eating? What happened? Anybody know? The golden calf happened. Fine. Good. Thanks for putting a negative spin on it. That's true. But what happened to him when he came down?
He
was shining. That's why some people still think Jews have horns, because the Torah says that there was a Karen Or, which is a light, but it could be misunderstood as horn. Karen is a horn also. And he had to put a masveh. I keep thinking about this in COVID. Masveh is a mask. He had to put a mask on because something happened, and the Jews couldn't handle it. Moshe was the greatest prophet. He got as close to God as any human being we believe can ever get. And he was beaming. He was literally spiritually beaming. That was supposed to be every Jew. They were supposed to get all 613, not come onto the mountain, just stand around the mountain and get it all. But they were like, we got enough directly, we'll get the rest from you. And that's all they really needed to have the authenticity that this was coming from God. Okay. Anyway, I hope that does that answer some
that's
of it?
It? Yeah. I mean that yeah.
There is another debate.
You acknowledge the ambiguity that I was uncertain of, Steve.
Right. Now there is another debate. When did Moses get the other 603? During the 40 days, 40 nights? That's one opinion, that's Maimonides. Others say no, that's too big of a pill for me to swallow. That he got it over the next 39 years. Every time God invited him into the Ol Moed, the tent of meeting, where the tabernacle was, that was the mobile sanctuary before the temple. Every time he was invited in there, God revealed another part of the Torah to him. And Moses would write it down. And here's the point that's really important. Take a look on page 3 now. It should be understood. This is Maimonides. I'm reading from Maimonides with you. It should be understood that every mitzvah that the Holy One, blessed is He, gave to Moshe, Moses our teacher, peace be unto him, was given to him together with its explanation. God would tell him the mitzvah, and afterwards He would give its explanation, its substance, and all the wisdom contained within the Torah's verses. Okay, good. So now here's what's your question on this now? Along with every command came an oral explanation. So God said, Basukot teshvu shivat yamim. On Sukkot you shall dwell for 7 days. How do you build a sukkah? Very specific, how to build a sukkah. What else are you supposed to do on Sukkot? You're supposed to take the four species. What are God told Moshe, Ulakachtem lachem pri eitz hadar, and you shall take for yourself the fruit of the eitz of the tree hadar, which is special. That's kind of vague. Which fruit? How did it become the weird lemon that gets sold for $50? A little fakakta lemon could be $100-$150. Well, how did that become the fruit? By the way, the Kabbalah teaches that's the fruit that Adam and Eve ate, not the apple. That's a Christian translation. But
really?
Yeah, they say it was an etrog. That's a whole other speech. But how did so all of that came to Moses. In other words, he had to remember it. It was given to him orally. Now, what's the question? What's the next question? If Moshe, who's a human being, let's say he's a genius human being, even with a photographic memory. Have you ever met anyone with a photographic memory? Okay, I've met a number of rabbis with photographic memories. They can actually teach, and you could see that they're seeing the page of the Talmud. They could see here, there's a Rashi over here, 2,771 pages. So let's say Moses had a photographic memory, or a really good memory. So then, how would that information continue to get passed on from generation to generation? It was never written down. What was written down? What's that? The written text, the Bible, the five books.
Was it all written at once? Was that all at the same time, or was it written down over time after Moshe?
So that's the debate that I just shared. According to one opinion, it was all written down during the 40 days and 40 nights. Maimonides says, the Rambam, that Moshe was like a stenographer for God. He literally he wrote word for word what God said.
And anticipated what was going to happen, so his own death.
So there's a very fascinating discussion about the last 8 verses in the Bible which describe Moses' death. So one interpretation in the Talmud is that Moshe wrote the last 8 with tears. That he actually, God told him, this is what's going to be. The other is that his lead disciple, Joshua, wrote those last 8. So there are debates, by the way. Not everything is 100% unanimously agreed upon. So the other opinion is not that Moses got all 5 books, during the 40 days, but during the 40 years, which is easier to believe a little. You know what I'm saying? Like, you didn't get to download all this information so quickly, but you got it over the 40-year period. Okay. Now, again, let's read the first paragraph again. With every mitzvah that was given to him came an explanation. And afterwards, what would you do before computers, before pen and paper, and you wanted to give over that information to other people? Not the written stuff, because the written stuff's written. So you could hand somebody. People were writing already. There's hieroglyphics. There's stuff that, you know, we have from Egypt that predated that, where people wrote things and carved into stone and so on and so forth. But how would you give over that oral information so that it could be preserved from generation to generation without actually writing it down?
You would tell multiple people at once.
Yeah. That's exact. Take a look at the next paragraph. He's quoting the Midrash rabbinic literature. The instruction of the Torah by Moses to the nation was as follows. Moses would enter his tent. Aaron, who was Aaron?
His brother.
Aaron was Moses' brother, following him first. Moses would tell Aaron the mitzvah once, teach it to him its explanation as it was given to him. Aaron would later withdraw to the right of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher. Then Eleazar and Itamar, Aaron's sons, would enter. Moses would tell them what he had just told Aaron, and they would withdraw. One would sit to the left of Moshe and the other to the right of Aaron. Then would come the 70 elders. Moses would instruct them as he had taught Aaron and his sons. Then the people and all those seeking Hashem would come, and he would set the mitzvah in order before them until they would hear it entirely from his lips. We find that Aaron would hear each mitzvah from the lips of Moses. How many times? Don't look down. How many times would Aaron hear it? Four times. Because he heard it directly first, and then he heard it again when his sons Eleazar and Itamar came in. Then he heard it again for the 70 scholars. And then he heard it again for the masses. The elders heard it. His sons heard it three times. The elders heard it twice. The rest of the people once. He kept doing this. What were the Jews doing for 40 years in the wilderness? They weren't just kvetching and complaining about their... It was hot and there was no water. You read the Bible, you read the story, it's just like they must have just been sitting around doing nothing all day. You know what our ancestors were doing? They were studying. We were the people of the book from the very beginning. Moses devised a system. It seems as though God had shared this with him, but it's a little unclear. Maybe he came up with this himself. And what happens in a class? So my son's in graduate school right now in Israel, and he was just asked to be a TA for one of the classes. He's studying social work. And I was talking to him, and I was like, that's amazing. What's your job? He says, well, when the professor is done, I'm supposed to, like, summarize and help him out with some of this, and I have to meet with him. No. So who is the TA here? Moses withdraw. Aaron would present a review and explain the mitzvah he had learned. By the way, almost every Talmud class that I've been to has like a TA. Who's the TA? The best student in the room. And the teacher leaves after giving the discourse. Now, sometimes the TAs are better than the teachers. When I studied international law, I studied under one of the great professors, Professor Henkin, Lewis Henkin. He wrote the book on international law. But he was a brilliant scholar and a religious Jew, so I don't want to say anything negative, but he wasn't a very inspiring, interesting orator or teacher. He was just a scholar. But he had this one unbelievably smart student at Columbia who was the TA, and I lived for the TA, even though I like telling everyone I'm in Professor Henkin's class. And the TA is very important. The TA here was Aaron. Aaron, it says Moses would withdraw. Aaron would present a review and explain the mitzvah he had learned, which he heard from Moses four times, and he would explain it to all present. Aaron would then withdraw, his sons having heard the mitzvah four times, three times from Moses, once from Aaron. That gave everybody another review of the information. Turn the page. Eleazar and Itamar would then review it after Aaron withdrew. So now the next would be the teachers. Teach the mitzvah to all the nation present, and then they would cease instruction. We find that the 70 elders would hear the mitzvah four times, twice from Moses, once from Aaron, once from Eleazar and Itamar. By the way, you can go on and on. This is Jewish history. This is how we preserved our oral tradition. Now, I want to ask you guys a question. Why would God gamble? Why wouldn't God just tell Moses on Sinai, every time he gave him something, write it down? I always tell my kids, as I'm telling you, write it down. Don't rely. Why not write it down? Why would he tell him? By the way, there's a verse in the Torah that says, can't write it down.
Because if you write it down, you become reliant on the book, and books can be burned.
So you just went into survival mode, which was very interesting. Books can be... I was just thinking, I was going a little more inspirational explanation. You gave like a very... It was really good. No, that was excellent. That's true. In other words, no matter how many books you... Do you know how many volumes... of in the 1200s, how many volumes of Talmud were burned in Paris? It's one of the keynote that we say on Tisha B'Av. Do you know how long it took to write a Talmud before the printing press? So that's actually a really good answer. I didn't even think of that. That was amazing. Meaning, no matter what happens, as long as there are Jews around, the tradition will always be around. What were you going to say?
Mm-hmm.
That's also
he
true.
He already knew.
I mean, I guess God knew.
Well, so it seems from God's perspective, he didn't want to just give it to Moses. He wanted to give it to everyone, but we said no. We were like, it's too much.
And the same thing, I have a question, like, why did Moses start with Aaron? Why didn't he just tell everybody?
I think, well, first of all, I don't even know. He has to somehow project to a lot of people. For amplification methodology, before there were loudspeakers and microphones, would be able to do this. So,
but to as many people as
well, he did eventually. I don't know. That's always the. I don't know. I have to think about that a little more. It's a good question. It's a really good question. Yeah, Barry.
I was going to answer the thing you asked. I think also, like I've heard at least, that if the Talmud or law were written down, you know, if other nations could start corrupting or claiming things about it. People could like manipulate it, and it could get really confusing about our
accepted. That's interesting. The truth is, you're right, because there were parts of the Talmud that have been censored. But we know also which parts. Brian, what were you going to say?
Or if something's written, it can be static.
That's it. See, that's what I was. You were talking about survival.
And if it's oral.
If it's oral, what is required to keep an oral tradition alive?
Understanding.
Not only understanding, what else?
For people to continue talking about.
A book can always collect dust on a shelf. And that's what happens with a lot of Jewish books. They just sit there.
Could people stop talking about it?
They could, but then it would die. In other words, the only way for Judaism to stop continuing, I don't mean Jewish people, but our Jewish wisdom, which is supposed to illuminate the world, that's why we're here, is to bring this wisdom to the world, it would stop if we stopped. And I think that's what God wanted. He wanted us to know that the minute we stop teaching this to our kids, the minute you and I stop having conversations about this with each other, and the minute it just ceases to be a living, dynamic part of our lives, and it just becomes a book, that's the beginning of the end. Yeah.
So then what would eventually have justified like recording information?
Good. So we know that it was written down. And anybody know who wrote it down? Not Maimonides, earlier than Maimonides. Okay, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, I'm skipping a little now, but maybe next week I'm going to go through the history. What happened when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, one of the great Torah scholars, was alive? What was going on in the Jewish community? That in his mind, and all the other scholars, he wasn't alone, necessitated going against the Torah and writing something down, publishing it. By the way, people took notes. It's not like people didn't write things down for themselves. You can. You just weren't supposed to write a book about it. But what happened in Jewish history? Anybody know the pivotal moment in Jewish history that changed everything? That convinced Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi and his colleagues that they had to change? They found another verse in the Torah to conflict with the other verse that said, don't write it down. Earlier. Keep going, but it's the same. Okay, it didn't happen yet, but the Roman conquest was starting. The Roman conquest was really, really awful because it was starting to spell the end of the Jews centered in Israel, and Jews were now going to be scattered all over the globe. We would be starting to become assimilated into other countries and other cultures. We would stop knowing our own native Hebrew language. And Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was really concerned that Judaism would literally be forgotten. So what he did was, he took the unpublished opinions of the leading scholars of his generation, and he put down, and that became what's called the
Gemara.
Not yet?
No, Mishnah.
What's before the Gemara?
Mishnah.
You should write this down. M-I-S-H-N-A. Mishnah. What does the word Mishnah actually mean? It just means review.
Yeah.
To lishanot means to go over, to review something.
Repetition.
Yeah, and the Mishnah is like, any lawyers, is this possible? There are no lawyers?
There's a lawyer.
Who's a lawyer?
Skylar's a lawyer.
Yeah.
Skylar, you're an attorney. So black letter law is like the Mishnah. It's like when you study for the bar a little, and you just got to memorize lots of laws. You're not really doing that in law school as much. Right? Law school, they're hopefully trying to teach us how to think. But then when you take the bar, you actually have to know what the law is. That's the Mishnah. The Mishnah is like sort of the bottom line black letter law. And then over the next 300 years after Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's death, all of these discussions, elaborations, applications of the law were written down in the form of what's called the Talmud. Okay? I want to go back. I did jump the gun a little. I'm not blaming you on that. You know. But I want to give some examples. Go back to page 4. It's almost 9. So just follow me on the bottom. I'm going to give you some examples. But going back to what we said before, look at the bottom of page 4 on the left. I'm going to give an example. For example, we're going back to Moses now. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moses, "In Sukkot you shall sit 7 days." Afterwards, He made it known that this mitzvah of Sukkah is obligatory upon all males, but not upon females. By the way, it's meritorious for a woman to sit in a Sukkah, but she's not obligated like a man. How do you know that? It doesn't say in the Bible only men are required to sit in a Sukkah. We have that as part of the oral tradition, that women are exempt from, and we'll talk about this another time, positive commandments that are time-bound. Sitting in a Sukkah is a time-bound mitzvah, therefore a woman is exempt. It's better if she can do it, but she doesn't have to. She's not commanded. What about if somebody is ill? Right? And what do you put on top of a Sukkah? Anybody know what that stuff is called? Tzchach. Tzchach. What does tzchach have to be made out of? Say that 10 times fast. By the way, I will know that you guys graduated fellowship with honors if you can like say words like tzchach. What does it have to be made out of? Anybody know? Right. It can be palm tree. Just anything that's gedulei karka, anything that is natural, comes from the ground. You can't have anything artificial up there.
What would have been considered artificial back in the day?
Oh, there's stuff. Right.
Anyway, yeah.
But it doesn't matter. See, that we want to get to a place where the Torah was not just given for times of antiquity. It was given for now, when we've got a lot of artificial stuff. You know what I mean? So what does it mean today? Sukkah must be roofed with detached products of the earth, not with wool or silk or a kilayim, including those products of the earth like pillows, quilts, and clothing. He made it known that eating, drinking, and sleeping all 7 days is an obligation. I talked about this on Sukkot. Somebody posted this on a friend of mine who was a rabbi in Omaha, Nebraska. And he has he's got a lot of congregants who are Husker fans. They're like crazy football Husker. So this one guy posted, he wanted to know, can he bring his Husker banner into the Sukkah? You know? And they also wanted to know if he could bring his flat screen TV in the Sukkah so you could watch the Husker game, because somebody told him you're supposed to actually live in the Sukkah and treat it like your home, and not just like visit it and make little kiddush in it and go back to your real house. So he schlepped in the TV, he put the Husker thing, he was like, it's supposed to be, how do you know that? So the Bible says, Basukot Teshuvu, you shall dwell. Now what does it mean to dwell? If I went around, everybody can give you, different answers. What it means to dwell is you should try to sleep. I don't know how many people were able to sleep. I didn't. My son slept in the Sukkah. It depends where you are and how, whatever. New York, I don't recommend it. In Israel, a lot of people sleep in the Sukkah. But a lot of us think of a Sukkah as like a nice little, sweet little hut thing that Jews visit. But you're actually supposed to live in it. Now, how do you know that? Again, then Moshe the prophet came, second paragraph. Hashem gave him this commandment plus its explanation, and thus it was with all the 613 commandments. The commandments were in writing, the explanation orally. We're finishing up. Came to pass after 40 years. In the 12th month, the first day of the month of Shvat, Moses gathered the people. He said, quote, "The time for my death is arriving. If there's any of you who heard a halakha, a law, but forgot it, let him come to me and I will explain it. Anyone who has any uncertainties about anything of the Torah, let him come and I will clarify the matter for him." Next paragraph, they acquired elucidation of the laws from Moses, halachot from Moshe, until they studied the explanations intensely from the first of Shvat until the seventh of Adar, Just before his death, Moses began to write the Torah in scrolls, 13 scrolls of Torah, on parchments, containing everything from the first letter, Bet, of Bereshit, in Genesis, to the Lamed of Le'enei Kol Yisrael, the last three words of the Torah. He gave one scroll to each of the 12 tribes. The 13th scroll he gave to the Levites and said that they should put it by the Ark of the Covenant. And if you turn the page, it's the last page that we're going to do today, on page 5. This is essentially how our oral tradition was passed down. Now there's one other area, and I'm sure many of you are asking this to yourself. Rabbi, if everything was so clear, then why is the Talmud filled with so many arguments? And why do rabbis keep arguing and debating each other? If everything was so clear, if the tefillin are black, and there's no red tefillin, and they're all square, and there's no round tefillin, then where are these arguments from? That was pretty cool. Where are these arguments from?
Which Talmud are you talking about?
Well, there are two Talmuds, one written in Babylonia, one in Israel. But they don't contradict each other. They're just one is written in Aramaic and one in Hebrew. Anybody know? So there were verses in the Torah that God purposely did not provide explanations for, but gave what's called in English the 13 hermeneutical principles to be used by the Sanhedrin. We're going to talk about the Sanhedrin next week. If it's okay if you don't understand what I'm about to say, because I'm going to elaborate more on this next week, but this is where all the arguments come from. Certain verses in the Torah, and I'll give you one example before we finish tonight, that God did not give an oral explanation for. So how do we figure out what it means? Or how to apply it? So these 13 hermeneutical methodologies. One is called Kal Vachomer. I'll talk about them next week. And the sages of the Sanhedrin, and there was a Sanhedrin in every generation from the days of Moses until the Romans disbanded it, around the time Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wrote the Mishnah. And they were entrusted, like the Supreme Court is, to interpret the biblical text using these 13 hermeneutical principles. Just like we have a constitution in this great country, and you and I can opine as to what we think the Second Amendment means, the right to bear arms, okay, and how far that should go, how much restriction should we put on that. But at the end of the day, you can't, you know, break the law because of your own interpretation of the Constitution. You have to follow the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution. Why? Because otherwise there'll be anarchy. Everybody will be doing their own thing because that's my opinion. Alan Dershowitz, a great legal scholar, but if he's driving 90 miles an hour in the freeway, the cops are going to pull him over and they're going to say, you're getting a ticket. And he'll be like, what do you mean? I've been teaching at Harvard Law School for 50 years, tenured professor. This is the way I interpret this clause in the Constitution. The cop's going to still write him a ticket. Why? Because last time I checked, he was never made a justice of the Supreme Court. That's the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin were the, not elected, we'll talk about that a little more next week, the 70 greatest scholars of every generation that were entrusted to interpret the biblical text where it was unclear, using these 13 divine hermeneutical principles to arrive at halacha. So I'll give you one example and I'll take your question, we're going to finish. One example is getting married. How do we get married? So all the Torah says, ki kach ish isha, when a man takes a woman. So what does that mean, when a man takes a woman? It's like the caveman, he goes, bam, pulls her under the chuppah, they get married. No, how do we get married? Anybody know? You've been to Jewish weddings, yeah?
Well, it follows the example in the Torah of the purchase of the Machpelah.
Okay, so but how do we get married?
Erusim.
A man gives the woman a ring, and she hopefully says yes and accepts it, and they get married, and it's witnessed.
So that's. Don't people give engagement rings? Isn't that a marriage?
No.
If you give her a ring.
That's a nice token of affection. That's not wedding in holy matrimony.
You just said it was giving a ring.
It is. So it has to be done for the sake of getting married.
Doesn't have to be a specific, like you have to get married with a kosher wedding band.
There's nothing kosher about it. You just want to make it easily ascertainable as to its value. Wow. But it's not.
It has to be like gold. It has to be really simple.
It's simple so we can know how much it's worth. That's all. So we know how much it's worth. But it has to be witnessed. That's actually the big difference. And you have to be doing it for the sake of marriage. When you get down on one knee and say, will you marry me? No one really thinks they're getting married with that. They think they're getting engaged. And then you could show off the ring and be in a little... But let me get back to this. That is learned from one of the 13 hermeneutical principles that the sages of the Sanhedrin used to interpret the biblical text, because there was no halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai. There was no passed down tradition as to how to read that phrase from the Bible, from the Torah. I'm going to give more examples next week. It's okay if you're not getting this 100%. Two last questions, we'll finish up.
Yeah, the Romans are gone. Why does no one reconstitute
the Sanhedrin? Excellent question. There have been people talking about this for centuries. Most of the are of the opinion that in order to reconstitute the Sanhedrin, it has to be part of a return, it has to be part of the Messianic redemption. It can't just... It needs to be within the context of the temple. The Sanhedrin actually adjudicated law in the temple. The temple can't be rebuilt without the Messiah. But there are some other opinions, minority opinions, but legitimate opinions that say that the Sanhedrin can be reconstituted even in the absence of a temple / Messiah. But then you'd have to get everyone to agree on who the 70 greatest scholars are. Good luck.
They tried to do it in 2010.
Vadi Yosef.
Yeah,
Vadi Yosef. Steinsaltz. No, Steinsaltz was part of it, I think.
Yeah.
Adin Steinsaltz.
It would
have to be like some sort of a test.
It is a minority opinion, though. The classic thing is that it has to be part of a return. Like the we'll come back to that also, actually. Yeah.
I'm confused sometimes between the difference between like what's an oral on the Talmud versus like a stringency there, or
good.
How do we know what you wrote?
Good. That is going to be, it's one of my goals, that you guys are going to finish this little mini-series called From Sinai to Manhattan to actually know what's the difference between a biblical law, a rabbinic law, and a custom. And if you see people doing what's called a chumrah, a stringency, where they do something beyond what the law requires. And that requires knowledge. And by the way, it's very important to know that, because a lot of people start thinking that this is so important to Judaism. And, you know, like wearing a kippah is very, very important. But it started as a custom and eventually developed into a rabbinic law. Okay? But a lot of the little things we may not even be aware of on the Sabbath are considered biblical. You're going to be able to tell the difference. Because I'm very big on that, and I feel like that way people can know also, because some of us are starting to become a little more observant, and I always do encourage people to start with like the simple biblical basics before getting into like the little rabbinic minutia. Not that they're not important, right? And sometimes we do things a little fakakt and backwards. That happens. That's called life. But we should know, and we're gonna do that.
That sounds good. One example of a potential like a confusion was like if people not actually like, from the oral law, from the Tanya stuff, or is there something
that you're up against? So maybe, do me a favor, bring that up next week. You're supposed to violate laws in order to preserve human life. There are three exceptions to that. Murder, sexual immorality, and idol worship. If somebody were to take a gun, kill this other person, or you will be killed. You're not permitted, the Talmud says, to kill the other person. Where do we get that? That's all based on verses from the Torah, so it is actually considered biblical. But we also get confused because sometimes rabbis say things that are biblical. But then we think, because a rabbi said it, must be rabbinic. And you'll say, well, what is the difference? If something you're not allowed to do something rabbinically, you can't do it anyway. It does matter. It does matter whether something is, you know, a prohibition on the biblical level versus the rabbinic versus the custom and so on and so forth.
But it's good to know that you can ask a question. First start to set to know. Is this a law? Is it a
And that's, by the way, one of the first things a rabbi does when we get a question and there are extenuating circumstances and someone's going through a difficult situation in their life, the first thing we're saying, okay, I'm dealing with a biblical law, this is going to be tough. You know what I mean? I'm dealing with rabbinic law, maybe I have a little more, you know, wiggle room. Custom, a lot of wiggle room. You know what I mean? I'm not saying not to take custom seriously, but there are extenuating circumstances and the like. You guys are going to become little experts in this. Isn't that cool? It'll be great. Okay, I don't want to take more time away from Rabbi Avi. I'm looking forward. By the way, we're having dinner together. Are we?
Yes.
We having dinner?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. We're looking forward. Join us at MG service at 6:30 on Friday night, and Shabbat dinner. It's going to be great. You can have a nice Shabbat.
Rabbi, 13.
Yeah, I'm gonna elaborate on that. I didn't even want to get into that yet. We'll do it
is
next
that,
week.
Is that what the Breita is?
Breita?
Breita?
No, that's not that. But the Breitas do discuss fundamental principles.
Okay. It's part of the, it's like part of the morning prayers, right?
Yeah. What's that?
Yeah. A little chilly.
What I'm referring to, I guess, oh. It shows up in the city already saw.
Morning. Yeah, the morning. Yeah,
that's why I wear a sweater. Sorry,
yeah, it goes to
lessons, but the morning prayers.
Yeah, it's part of the brachot that's around.
Couldn't do it at the table, right?
It's good, right?
Yeah, please.
Okay, more on it later.
From Sinai to Manhattan. Oh, I think maybe I want a triple whole plus one, too.
Are we going to be
one of these babies? There is a couple of the pages in here are my contribution. It's true. I can tell you which parts are my contribution to this. You're not up to it, right? Oh yeah, these ones. There's a problem here, by the way. There's a missing source here. Oh yeah, I'll find it for you. I have it. See, Rabbi Avi Heller. I'm not kidding. It's actually in there. About two pages. No, actually four pages.
Cheers. 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 There's a sign that says sign
in
fellowship sign
in.
What? Your
bag.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Oh, you're going to get
fine. No worries. If we do triangles next time, we'll do next time. Okay, good.
I just didn't know if there was a spot. You know you won't.
These are for you.
Stop right there.
Wait, what's for me? What, to give out to people?
Yeah.
You didn't do it before.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We have new stuff for you to put in your binders that was not ready last week. So some of the stuff in your binders you're going to replace with this.
It's actually all of the stuff.
All of it? It's everything.
All,
it's all the stuff in the Google Drive.
Heading.
So if you want to just use the Google Drive, you may do that. But you can also have it hard copy here. So these are beautiful folders, so I'm passing them out to you. It includes a fellowship roster. There you go, Skylar. You want to give you a purple one. At least you can have a blue one. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. What? You want a pink one? There, pass those down on the east if you don't mind. And whoever else comes in can get one. I guess we have someone here. And we hole punch them so you can just stick them right in your packet, your binders if you want. I will leave the rest of these.
Oh, maybe
for him.
Oh. You need another one? It's okay.
So last year, I don't have everybody yet. Last year I taught this Jewish history course in 3 sessions.
Oh,
this year we're going to do it in 5.
Okay.
Let's
I thought
hope,
you were saying one.
I mean, it was like a supersonic shuttle trying to do this in 3 courses. It was impossible. So we're going to do 3 in the fall, and then we'll do 2 later.
Okay.
That's the plan. Thank you. Beautiful. No, that's exactly what I'm so excited about, these triangles. When am I giving them to them?
I don't know. You have that.
When was I going to give this to them? It's like the Holy Trinity. When? Why did I want to do this? Maybe after Rashi. I will see if we get up to it or not. Anybody else get one of these folders? Jory, you need one of these, right? Is this you? I gave you one already then. You got a blue one.
Oh, no, this isn't me.
No.
Now you're here.
No. Thank you so much.
Anybody else need a folder? Alana, did you get one of these?
No.
Okay, Ethan, when you come back in, close that door. We'll start.
Online,
but this is a hard copy. Anybody else need a hard copy? I have tons of stuff for you guys tonight. We are going to start with this.
I never really thought about it.
Okay, take one of these and pass it around.
This roster has everybody on it?
Yeah.
It has everybody on it. I think if we miss someone, let me know.
There's 19 actually.
Yeah, there's 19 of you now. 20 is an easier number. Here, take one of these and pass it along.
No, no.
Take that and pass it. There's someone here. I'll give you. I like the purple. I like the. It's magenta. Right?
Yeah, it's magenta. You know what?
Yeah,
I have the green one already.
Okay, you don't need one. Decide which color you like. It's fine. You can exchange it. Okay, so I have a close that door. I'm going to start. Starting 982.
We need another close.
I knew from just from people saying.
So, anybody else need a folder? Did you get a folder?
Yeah, yeah, I did. Could you pass me one of these pens? Thank you. How was your desk?
We only need one of these Cornell.
Not over yet. Maria, do you got one of these? Here, pass that over to her. Okay.
I think everybody got one of these.
All right, fantastic. Anybody else need a Cornell method? Miranda, did you get one of these? You got it. Okay. Before we start, I just want to share with you, I was never heard about this until about a month ago.
Yeah.
And I love it. And I just feel like you should share. Anybody ever hear of the Cornell method of taking notes? Raise your hand if you've heard of this.
It was invented by Professor Abbott.
Harvard.
not that long ago, a couple centuries ago.